Welcome to Fisherwomen. I'm Katie Osborne. Today I'll be sharing some of my favorite fish stories about parental care in fishes. I promise they're not crappie, and I hope this mini episode helps tide you over until the upcoming episode with Sarah O'Neill on Pebble Mine and Bristol Bay, which I can't wait to share with you. When we think of parenting in nature, we think of the images shown in documentaries. Heartwarming footage of mother and cub, mother and pup, mother and chick. But in the fish world, if there's a lead parent, it's usually dad. Some dads, like pipefish and seahorses, carry their eggs on their stomach. Others build nests, and some hang clusters of eggs like bunches of grapes off a forehead hook specialized for the very purpose. For those who'd like to reap the rewards of raising fish in aquaria, few are as joyous as the splashing tetra, Coppella arnoldi, a tropical freshwater fish native to South America. The male finds a nice, leafy branch overhanging his bit of river and tries to show off how generally fantastic and wonderful he is to passing ladyfish. If a female decides to mate with him, she'll swim alongside and together they'll leap into the air, suction themselves to a leaf with their fins, and lay and fertilize 6 to 8 eggs before dropping back to the water. The pair will repeat their acrobatics again and again until as many as 200 eggs hang from the leaf's underside. Then the female will swim off, but the male will stay behind and tend to the eggs. He will splash them with his asymmetrical tail as frequently as necessary to keep them moist. After days of regular splashing, the eggs will hatch, and the young will plop down into the water and swim for cover. Then there's the species that's the subject of this episode's cover photo, the three-spined stickleback, Gastrosteus aculeatus. This fish is named, logically, for the three spines along the back, immediately in front of the dorsal fin. Individuals also have a spine in each of their pectoral fins, the fins on either side of the head. When threatened, the stickleback can raise a protective mane of points sticking out in 3 directions from his head. For this small fish, being a spiky mouthful is a helpful way to keep would-be predators at bay. Female sticklebacks are larger than the males, with some reaching a whopping 3 inches in length. You can find three-spined sticklebacks in coastal waters and rivers on both North American coasts, in Europe, and in parts of Asia. This widespread and abundant species is one of my favorite fishes. I hope you'll see why once you've heard this story. On average, sticklebacks reach maturity at 2 years of age. In the spring, mature individuals move to shallow waters. When it comes time to mate, the male three-spined stickleback acquires an orange to rosy hue across his throat and large pectorals. He establishes a territory that he will defend through the mating season, which ends midsummer. Once a male has chosen his territory, he'll slave for hours over his nest. He digs a hole in the substrate, piles leafy debris on top, and glues together the mass with spiggin, which sounds like spit, but is made by the kidneys. Then he swims vigorously through the mass to form a tunnel. Once his work is done, he'll set about charming a potential mate with his delightful zigzag dance. He finds a spot where he can be easily seen by passing females, and then he swims back and forth to show off the bright red of his throat and his large pectoral fins. Should a ladyfish show interest, he'll dance a zigzag back to his nest and nod towards it, inviting her inside, or swim through the tunnel to show her the way. After she's laid her eggs, he chases her off and returns to his dance spot to woo another female. The male may solicit several females in this way, but he will chase off each and every one once they've laid their eggs. He'll also chase off any other males or non-egg-bearing females. Once the male is satisfied with the size of his brood, he'll hover at the entrance to his nest and fan his pectoral fins tirelessly night and day to circulate fresh water through it, keeping the eggs oxygenated until they hatch 7 to 8 days later. The male will alter how fast he fans his eggs in response to the environment and the egg's needs. For example, in low oxygen waters, dad will fan his eggs more vigorously to get them more oxygen. He'll also pick up the pace as the eggs mature, and even make holes in the nest to increase ventilation, as the oxygen needs of his young increase as the eggs age. It's even been shown that these attentive fish fathers change their parenting tactics in response to predation pressure. In areas with lots of predators, dad provides less oxygen, resulting in smaller, less colorful young, who are less likely to attract a predator's attention. For the first few days after hatch, dad continues to care for his young, picking up any wanderers in his mouth like stray lambs and depositing them back safely into the nest. A few days later, after all the young have used up their yolk sacs and left the nest for good, dad may repeat the whole process, even knocking down his original nest to start afresh. If and when he lacks the energy to raise another brood, he dies of exhaustion. Female sticklebacks also die after their first mating season, having invested all their energy into their eggs. Other fish fathers skip the nest altogether and shepherd their young in their mouths instead. This is called mouth brooding and is thought to have evolved from nesting behavior. Parents would use their mouths to transfer eggs into the nest, and over time this evolved into just carrying the eggs around in one's mouth. It's evolved independently in several fish families, sea catfish, jawfishes, and arowanas to name a few. In most of these families, it's always the male who does the mouth brooding. This is the case with cardinal fish, a family of colorful tropical fishes where all mouth brooding species are exclusively paternal mouth brooders, like the Bangai cardinal fish, Pterypogon cowderni, native to the Bangai archipelago in eastern Indonesia. And apologies if I'm pronouncing the name of that archipelago incorrectly. Male Bangai cardinal fish care for the eggs, so the females do the courting. The female will dance to woo her mate, quivering her body and tail or bowing her head. After some hours of courtship, they'll mate in early evening. Once she's mostly released her batch of eggs, the male will swallow them up, pulling out the last. He carries the eggs safely in his mouth for about 20 days until they hatch. During this time, he'll seclude himself to safer areas, forego eating, and breathe around a mouthful of living marbles. Once the eggs hatch, he'll let them shelter in his mouth for an additional 6 to 10 days until they've mostly used up their yolk sacs and need to start foraging on their own for food. When larvae leave dad for good, they quickly flee for cover, because dad hasn't eaten in days, and once they're on their own, he's prone to eating them. Some cardinal fish fathers also have the bad habit of swallowing some or even all of their brood before hatching. Weighing up to 1,000 pounds, making them the largest of the tuna species. As adults, bluefin tuna are top predators in a complex marine food web with more trophic levels than land-based food webs. Yet they start out at the very bottom of that food web, as tiny, translucent larvae 2 to 3 millimeters long. Recently, researchers confirmed the presence of a previously hypothesized spawning ground for Atlantic bluefin tuna off the northeast coast of the United States. It's called the Slope Sea, and lies between the North American continental plate to the north and the Gulf Stream where it peels away from the coastline to the south. In July, currents in the Slope Sea keep warm water and suspended particles circulating around in the same general area. So mid-summer, when Atlantic bluefin tuna are passing through the region, The slope sea provides an area that will retain their larvae in the relatively warm waters of 23 to 28 degrees Celsius that they need to survive their first month of life. After about 25 days, tuna larvae are big enough to swim independently of those circulating currents and can exit the slope sea. While in the slope, larvae grow about 0.5 millimeter per day, which is pretty speedy for a fish that starts out as only 2 to 3 millimeters long. Cocooned in the warm waters of the slope, the larval tuna feed on plankton and are also part of the planktonic community of the slope sea. A female tuna can lay anywhere from 5 to 45 million eggs as her fecundity increases with age. So some of the most readily available plankton for a larval tuna to eat are fellow Atlantic bluefin tuna larvae. Naturally, cannibalism is common. When you lay millions of eggs, few need to survive to adulthood to assure the future of the species. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and thank you so much for listening. If you want to learn more about the paternal fishes discussed or the decidedly non-parental Atlantic bluefin tuna, please refer to the resources listed in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. It really helps. Theme was mixed by me using sound sourced from SFX Go, Orange Free Sound, and Freesound. For a complete list of credits, please visit the website at fisherwomanpod.wordpress.com. There you can also find contact information, how to submit a creature feature, and links to the Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter accounts for the Fisherwomen podcast. Follow Fisherwomen on your preferred social media platform for announcements on upcoming episodes, interesting fish stories, and fun fish photos. Until next time, happy fishing!